Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
To be honest with you, there were times when I was senior advisor to President Obama when I wanted to thrash Jake Tapper. He was the White House correspondent for ABC, smart and challenging and sometimes a real pain in the butt. And I've watched his evolution now to become such a presence on CNN as an anchor of their show, The Lead. I sat down with Jake the other day at CNN in Washington to talk about his career, his books, including a new one, The Hellfire Club, a thriller that comes out in April, his cartooning, and the challenges of being a reporter and anchor in the era of Trump. Jake Tapper, great to be with you.
Good to see you, sir.
I didn't realize, because I always thought of you as a good Jew from Philly, that
annoying, an annoying Jew from Philly.
Well,
because I was a reporter and you were a
exactly. Well, yeah, you know, we'll get into that. But that your family on your mother's side goes way back to the Revolutionary War, and not even on the right side.
That's true. It's true. My mom's. We did this in when we did the genealogy project here at CNN. So it was so weird because I grew up in Philly and I was seven during the bicentennial. And Philadelphia is just steeped in colonial America, and it really was when during my childhood. And our teams are named the Eagles and
yes,
the Liberty Bells and the 76ers
yes,
and everything like that. So when we did this genealogy project for CNN, I found out that I actually had roots in the American Revolution, which is very exciting. But then, of course, it turned out that they were fighting on the wrong side. They were on the British side, and then they lost, and then they fled to Canada. And then they were on the wrong side again in the War of 1812. So, I mean, the way that my mom's side of the family, the Canadian side, which is my mom converted to Judaism, so that side was Protestant. And the way it had always been sold to me was, you know, that our ancestors went to Canada because slavery was not legal in Canada. Like, we were very pious and high and mighty. And it turns out, no, we were on the wrong side. We were on the wrong side of the American Revolution. And that's why we were in Canada.
Sounds shrewd that they went, though. So there's some smarts there.
Yeah. Well,
except picking the wrong side.
Right. I mean, I guess, you know, when we looked at this for the project, it was, I guess, a third of the country was with the colonialists, a third of the country was with the royals, and a third didn't care. A third was just, you know, whatever. And so they picked the wrong horse. But it's okay.
And where'd your dad's family come from originally?
As you know, they're from Chicago.
But way back when.
My dad's grandfather, first of all, he arrived in Chicago, and we can't find any history of him before he arrived in Chicago. He came from a boat through Canada, I think. But, Poland, Russia, Lithuania, Latvia, just a lot of records that were destroyed during World War II.
And when did he get here? My
dad's grandfather, Tapper, arrived around the turn of the century. And we can't find any records about him other than his arrival. It's really incredible. I mean, that's one of the reasons why Ancestry.com is so cool. They should sponsor this podcast if they haven't, because I'm about to say. I mean, their algorithm where you put in a name and then that just searches for that person. It's just incredible. So now we have his swearing of loyalty to the United States of America and all this stuff from 1901, 1902, these documents. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. When I was writing my book, my father was an immigrant, and I didn't really know because he had such a horrendous childhood in the pogroms, and he really never wanted to talk about it. Other than the kind of random reference to stepping over bodies when he and his father went to get bread and stuff like that. But
they were from Russia? Where were
they were from what is now Ukraine.
Okay.
I didn't know a lot of the, you know, I knew a lot of family lore. I didn't know exactly what their route was. They did come through Canada, spent a year there, came down, but, you know, had to do all this research. And no, they ended up in New York.
Oh, okay.
He grew up in, my family's from, I'm from New York.
Okay.
So I went to Chicago to go to college and just never left, but, and left my New York accent behind.
Yeah, it's not there.
I know. I'm a Midwesterner now.
I see. I don't think I have an accent, but Philadelphians hear my accent and my
that's good.
All the time. So
you want to be embraced by your hometown?
Yeah, no, they do. They embrace me. But it's funny because
you got a lot of pub around the Eagles.
I did. Well, I've been an Eagles fan since I can remember football, and they were in the Super Bowl when I was 10, and then again when I was 34. And
who was
and
it? Ron Jaworski back then.
Jaws, Bill Berge. Yeah. I mean, you know, yes. Randall Cunningham in the second iteration. And anyway. So this was incredible, and the Eagles reached out and got me tickets. Me and my dad got tickets to the NFC Championship game in Philly, and then Zucker was nice enough to get me tickets to the Super Bowl.
What a game!
Oh my God! I mean, the best football game I've ever seen in my life. But yeah, I'm biased.
It was even for those of us who didn't have a particular rooting interest. It was a fun game. So you were raised. Pretty significantly in a Jewish tradition, Jewish schools.
My mom converted to Judaism, and my dad was raised conservative Jewish, but probably not really all that observant. And then around the time of, they divorced when I was about 7 or 8, and around that time, my dad started getting more in touch with his Jewish roots. And so I started going to Jewish camps, and then I ended up in Jewish school from 6 through 12. And
you live with your dad?
We did joint custody, so it was, you know, split down the middle. There was some sort of awakening that my dad went through, maybe right before and during the divorce, and so I learned a lot about Judaism, and I spoke semi-fluent Hebrew for a while during when I was in college. Not really anymore.
And did you, was there a spiritual component to it? I mean, I was raised, I was bar mitzvahed and all of that. But it was and I feel culturally akin, but it was kind of a compulsory thing. And so compulsory, I was resistant to it.
That's probably what my kids are going through right now. For me, it was different because... I guess like any other spiritual journey, I went through periods where I was very, very into it. When you go to Jewish camps, and when I say Jewish camps, I don't just mean like everybody there was Jewish. I mean, we'd get up and we would pray. And then every day of the week. And then on the Sabbath, it was very, a very intense situation where, you couldn't use electronics and all that. And there'd be a lot of praying, and there are times in my life that I was really into it and other times that I'm not. And I would say right now it's important to me, but I'm also at the phase of my life. And maybe this is a silly phase where I think that, I don't really think God cares too much about what I eat and, put in my body. And I think that God probably, if there is any sort of sense of justice in this universe, would prefer that I spend more time devoted to doing good deeds, which is part of Judaism, than praying.
Do you have proof of this, or do you have two sources on this?
I have no sources on this. I have not reported this, but I think a lot of the lessons of Judaism have stayed with me in terms of trying to be a good person and trying to give people the benefit of the doubt, and in terms of charity and that part of Judaism, and the intellectual debate that's part of Judaism as well, that has stayed with me much more than the religious part of it, and just in terms of observance, in terms of, so we go to synagogue, my kids go to Hebrew school and all that, but...
You're reaching for the deeper, you're reaching for the sort of more spiritual elements, that the ethical constructs and so on.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes I see some very unethical behavior by people who think that they are very observant, not just Jews, but all sorts of religions. Mm-hmm. So I see that all. I was just thinking it today. Somebody who looks as though he is a Orthodox Jew on Twitter was attacking me. And all I could think of was,
how does one look like an Orthodox Jew on Twitter?
Well, his avatar was, you know, a guy with a hat and payas and all that. And all I could think of was, this is not what I learned is being Jewish. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, that's to me. And so I've seen a lot of that behavior. Again, not just Jews.
Yeah,
Christians, Muslims.
No, there's plenty of discussion of that.
Certainly Muslims. I mean, you know, and a lot of people who consider themselves to be very pious doing some pretty horrific things.
You were involved in distributing a little newspaper around your neighborhood when you were a kid.
JT's, if you please. We had a naming contest.
That sounds like an oil change.
No, JT's, my mission. JT's, if you please. It was, you know, we had a naming contest. I forget exactly. I was maybe 4 or 5, something like that.
So was that, was news and politics, were these things that were discussed around your house?
Politics was. Mm-hmm. I was steeped in politics, my brother too. I have very vivid memories of my parents talking about Nixon, my mom watching Watergate on the black and white set in the living room. My dad is very proud. We had the mayor at the time in Philadelphia,
Frank
was a guy
Rizzo.
Named Frank Rizzo,
yeah.
Democrat, real bully, racist. Former police commissioner, and very abusive. And the first drawings I ever did was a picture of Frank Rizzo, and it just said "Bad Rizzo, Bad Rizzo, Bad Rizzo" over and over and over. I was probably like 4, and it was. We were really steeped in senses of justice and bad guys who ran the country and the city.
By the time you were a teenager, there was this huge race, and the first African-American mayor of Philadelphia,
Wilson Good,
got elected. And there was a lot of, I mean, I was covering City Hall in Chicago in the same year when the first African-American mayor of Chicago.
Harold Washington, sure.
Yeah. Was that, do you remember all of that?
I do, but you know, I didn't look at it that way, even though I know that the election of Wilson Good was a great and historic thing for Philadelphia, because he was a pretty crappy mayor.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't politically correct in the sense that we thought that just because somebody was a woman or an African American or Jewish or whatever, that we immediately just assumed and ascribed good things. He was a bad mayor, and there was that horrible incident with the MOVE cult where he ordered the police commissioner to drop a bomb and blew up a whole
city.
Now,
Ed Randell ran against him in the first race.
I worked on that campaign. I was a 17-year-old in high school, and it was my senior work project. And I was an intern on Ed Randell, his first race against Wilson Good, which he lost in the primary.
Yeah. And then
Neil Oxman did the ads, you might remember.
I do remember that. Yeah. I do remember that. The cartooning.
Yeah.
Was something you picked up early as well.
I was always doing that. Yeah, Charlie Brown. I was a big fan of Peanuts and Charles Schultz and Pogo through my grandparents. And it was always just seemed to be part and parcel of the same thing, commentary and about the human condition or about politics. Tony Auth was the political cartoonist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. When I was in high school, he would let me come by his office and talk to him about being a professional cartoonist.
You were a Mad Magazine guy too.
Huge Mad Magazine guy. Loved Mad Magazine in the 70s. I remember the first one I bought for like 25 cents. Had a fake Henry Winkler on the cover. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean,
but there are lots of people like, I read comics voraciously.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the things I deeply resented was when I went away to college, my mother threw them out.
My grandmother did that to my dad.
Yeah. I had like the first Spider-Man, I mean, I had all of these things. Like, she's gone now. I think if she knew what those comic books ended up being worth, she would have been really appalled about it. But
appalled that she threw them out and appalled that they would be worth that much.
Along with my baseball cards, my autograph collection. But I don't want to get into my own problems here, but lots of us were voracious readers of these things. But not everybody can draw.
Yeah, well, that's just a skill that I don't think I'm any great cartoonist, but I have a talent of some sort that I just think I had when I was a kid and just always loved drawing, and I did it throughout high school and I did it in college. At one point, I wanted to be a professional cartoonist after college. I tried to get a syndicated comic strip. I came close, but it didn't work out. And now I met Gary Trudeau when President Obama's first trip to 10 Downing Street. Gary Trudeau was outside, and I recognized it. I'm like, oh, my God, you're Gary Trudeau. He's the, for those who don't know, he's the guy, the creator
Doonesbury,
of Doonesbury.
Yes.
One of the top 10 comic strips of all time.
Yeah.
He said that he doesn't, when people come to him, when kids come to him who want to be cartoonists, he tells them to go into animation. He tells them to move to L.A. Don't even do comic strip cartooning anymore. It's not worth it. Newspapers are folding. They're shrinking the size of the strips, et cetera. So,
you got into trouble with your cartooning in high school.
I did.
What happened?
So I don't know what we were rebelling against.
You were rebelling against a lot of things. So the way you were described by your classmates and teachers were you were a guy who was challenging authority even then. This will not come as a surprise to viewers of your program. But.
Yeah, no. And I remember actually after this story that I'm about to tell you happened, the principal telling me that I had a problem with authority and I needed to figure out how to deal with it
or become a journalist.
Yeah. He should have just said that. We did a Mad Magazine type fold in the back of the yearbook where the ads are, and it said to the school congratulations on your 40th year, and there were these big balloon cartoon of 40th year, and then when you folded it in, if you knew to fold it in. Like Mad Magazine has the fold-in, it formed an appendage, a male appendage, and it said, for all the BS,
Hands or feet, right?
No, and it was I had some co-conspirators who helped me sneak it into the yearbook because I was not on the yearbook staff. But
do they also have to do 75 hours of community service?
Yeah, we all did. There were seven of us, or six or seven of us, and we all had to
All of Philly must have been enhanced by this.
It was a huge scandal at the time. It was not written about. Today it would be, but it was a pretty within the Jewish community in Philadelphia. It was a pretty big deal. And then 10 years later, I wrote about it for Philadelphia Magazine, and I said, I think it's funny and all that, but I'm embarrassed about it because I don't know what I was rebelling against. What was I so mad about? I mean, it was such a mean thing to say. And, there was nobody I hated at that school. There were no teachers that were cruel or
but
mean.
But that's part of being,
I guess,
an adolescent. And, it's good that it.
It could have just been the appendage without the mean statement. Do you know what I mean? It could have just been like. But I just had to have the last word and had to get one over on them and but they found out about it before we graduated, so then we had problems.
Yeah. And then when you went to Dartmouth, you were a cartoonist in the Dartmouth
the Daily
paper
Day.
There. And I saw somewhere that one of your professors recognized himself in one of your cartoons in which the students were not paying a great deal of attention to what he was saying. How'd that go over?
Well, it wasn't meant as an insult. That was meant as an homage. That was I just had to draw a professor at the front of the classroom, and I just drew my history professor. It didn't say his name or anything, so I guess he just recognized the caricature was good enough that he knew.
You didn't say you're lucky. It could have been a phallus.
Right, exactly. It could have folded. He doesn't even know what the bullet he dodged. He ended up going on to be the president of Dartmouth, and he remains a friend, James Wright. He's a really good guy and a really, really nice man, and a former Marine. He's a very impressive guy. So he knows it was not meant to in anything other.
When
than,
you were done, you headed out to California and you thought about film.
Well, I just didn't know what to do, and then everybody was going to law school, and I knew I didn't want to do that. And there's no.
Why didn't you want to do that? You're a guy who loves a good scrum.
I wanted to do something creative and something that I would enjoy, and business school or law school, none of that seemed appealing to me. And I wanted to be a cartoonist, and I had taken a bunch of film classes, and they had been fun and enjoyable, and the people there the film professors who were, you know, legit guys. One of them had written a whole bunch of Hitchcock movies. One of them had written a bunch of Disney movies, and they seemed to think I was pretty good at screenwriting. So I went out to USC, but I thought it was a huge waste of time, the program that I was in. And, I was not motivated, so I don't mean that as a knock at USC. I'm sure a lot of people got a lot out of it. But I also found myself sitting in class listening to the Clarence Thomas hearings on my Walkman, which for kids listening, that's like an iPod or an iPad. What is it? I don't even know what kids use anymore.
Yeah.
It's like your iPhone.
I thought you were going to say, for the kids who are listening, what the Clarence Thomas hearings were.
Well, they can Google that. But I was listening.
That speaking of obscene references, yeah, that figured in there as well.
Well, I just remember listening. I mean, I just listened, and then I would just listen to the Senate hearings. I mean, it's just fascinating. I remember Arlen Specter just being, who was my home state senator, being really nasty to Ted Kennedy. The people of America don't need to be lectured from Senator Kennedy on the treatment of women. Remember that?
Yeah.
And it was just like, you got some really good. I mean, by the way, he had a point.
A cheap but easy shot.
But
there.
He had a point.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
So you decided that you were interested in politics.
Kind of. It was more that I didn't know what to do. And I came back. I did a semester. And then also, by the way, I was paying for it. That also probably, that's an important part of the story.
Yeah.
My dad was not going to pay for it, film school.
Yeah.
And so I had to pay for it. So I had to make the decision, was I really going to go into $100,000 debt for this?
Yeah. Speaking of paying for it, we got to take a short break. Yeah. We'll be right back with Jake Tapper. So you went to work for a woman who's running for Congress.
A family friend, really. I mean, this
Marjorie Margolies Mezvinsky, who I know as well, and who became famous later in life as Chelsea Clinton's mother-in-law.
Yeah, that was long after me.
No, but she actually became famous. You went to the Hill with her, right?
Yeah.
Were you there when she voted for the tax bill?
Yeah.
This is a remarkable story, actually, because she, I think, courageously cast one of the deciding votes for President Clinton's tax increase because he was trying to close deficits, and the Republicans were singing goodbye Marjorie.
Yeah, it was tough. So she was a family friend, and I was at home and I had nothing to do. I had just come back from film school, and I picked up the paper and I saw that Larry Coughlin, a 24-year moderate Republican incumbent, was resigning, and it mentioned Marjorie as somebody who might run for the seat. So I called her. Again, I had nothing to do. Like, literally. Like, you know, and your parents are like, well, what are you going to do with your life? And
yeah, it's like The Graduate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Except we didn't have a pool. And it was Philadelphia in the winter. So it was not quite like The Graduate, but that same directionlessness. And also, there was no Mrs. Robinson.
Yes, all right.
So Benjamin Braddock had it much better than I did, is the point I'm trying to make. So I just went out there and I worked on her campaign, and then she won. And then I came down to Washington. Again, like when you're young,
right,
you're just looking for anything to do. And so I worked for her.
Were her press secretary.
I was her press secretary. And she said that she would vote against the president's budget because I think there are only three congressional districts in the country where more people would be hurt by the tax increase than would be helped by the
because it was really an upper end tax increase.
It was an upper end tax increase.
Was an affluent district.
Yeah, but there was also like the earned income tax credit was part of this bill. So most districts, it was a net positive for them. But we were one of three districts where there were so many rich people and so few poor people. We spent months and months saying she was going to vote against it, but she also told the Clintons, I will not be the one that sinks it. And the Democratic Party did a really cruddy job of protecting vulnerable Democrats, and all these like chairmen voted against it and all these others, but all these vulnerable House women mainly voted for it. And a bunch of them lost the next year. But I left a few months after her budget vote.
You said somewhere, I was awful at it. I was the worst. I'm not a particularly good liar.
Yeah.
Do you think that's the job of a press secretary?
I think it's part of it. I think spinning it. And I'm not accusing you, per se, of lying.
No, I mean, you know.
But
not taking it personally.
Yeah. I think that there is a degree of... Well, first of all, let me just say, I'm much more wired to run right for the uncomfortable truth. And that is not a particularly good quality at a party, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But it is just how I am wired. So
goes back to the anti-authority thing, probably.
Maybe, or just yeah. I'm a jerk. But the idea that it's not just lying. It's also like spinning, telling the story you want to tell, telling a positive story. And I can go back and I remember things that I have said as a spokesperson, whether for Marjorie or for other clients, that you can just see, like, I'm
not good at it.
No, I mean,
I went from journalism to politics, and the challenging thing is to tell a narrative and as you say, spin without being mendacious about
right.
it. I mean, and it's hard, and you've got to sort of live with yourself. And sometimes, I remember having to go out and try and explain after the first debate in 2012 in Denver, which you'll remember well, not the finest moment for President Obama, why it actually was better than people thought. And it's like, they saw it. We all saw it.
Right.
There was nothing I really could say, and I felt kind of stupid trying. But
that's kind of the job is like
right.
you kind of have to like put so even if it's not a lie per se, it is not
right.
It's not.
So you weren't
truth.
Comfortable with that.
I'm bad at it. There was a time when I worked in PR. After I left Marjorie's office, I worked in PR.
Yeah, which seems like the same thing.
It's the same thing. It's worse. But again, I was just like I didn't know what to do. It hadn't dawned on me to do journalism. In the PR job, it dawned on me to do journalism, and then I got
you
out
did.
And I started doing journalism. But I remember one time we were representing Hooters. Hooters was being threatened with a lawsuit from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for not hiring men as Hooters girls. This is a real thing. This really happened. And I remember one time, because they put me on the account, which was a bad mistake and for any number of reasons, but I remember
write some Hooters briefs for us.
But I remember one time talking to a reporter, and I said something like, you know, it's not like the girls are naked. It's like, that's not what you say. You're supposed to say, like, you know, these are lovely ladies wearing they have clothes on from neck to
yeah.
neck to whatever. I mean, like,
yeah.
it's not like these girls are naked. It's just awful PR. I mean, like, I don't know why I thought about that the other day. Just like, what a stupid thing to say. I think it was inside. I was just like saying, you're not good at this. Leave this business.
You went to, wait a second.
I did handgun control for like a few months in there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what did you do that? Because you were drawn to the cause, or
I did that because I hated working in public relations. Jim Brady and Sarah Brady were there, and they were good people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was—it's hard to remember this now, but it was a bipartisan organization
yes.
at the time.
Well, yes, they were Republicans.
They were Republicans, and gun control was not what it is today. I mean, we were talking about things like trigger locks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That was just, at that point, I knew I wanted to be a journalist, and I was just trying to get a full-time job in journalism, and I left the PR firm. Again, I was awful at it, and
yes.
so I got another job that made a little bit more money, and it seemed like I might be a little bit better at it, and while I got waited for the journalism job.
You went to the city paper.
Then that was the first full-time
journalist. In Washington,
journalist. Yeah,
which was sort of a legendary place when you were there, primarily because of the editor,
David Carr. Yeah, he's the one that convinced me to come work at City Paper, take my salary went down a third, but go do what he was doing and learn how to do journalism at his feet, which was one of the best career moves of my life. I'd say the three best career moves I ever had were, or four, going to City Paper, going to Salon, going to ABC, and then coming to CNN. Those four.
So David Carr, we had Ta-Nehisi Coates here
yeah.
some months ago, and you were there when he was there, right?
Well, I was full time. He was some kid at Howard University that would come in and do music reviews, and Carr would teach him how to write. Now he's literally
beyond brilliant,
literally a genius award winner. But David saw in him that, and I mean, he was always a great. I knew
David had his own interesting history. He was a drug addict and all that, but hard bitten news guy, like the editor that everybody always wants to have.
He was legendary.
And, yeah, but tough.
Very tough. It was very tough, and I have to say, I could have probably stood another year there, but I was there for about a year and change, and then Salon.com came hiring to cover the 99-2000 presidential race.
And which was the 99-2000, yeah, but which was what was the period of time in which you dated Monica Lewinsky?
Oh, so that was, first of all, it was just one date.
Yes.
Right. So that was my first cover story for City Paper. And the date had happened in December 97, and I went on vacation with my dad, and I had gotten two offers to work, either go work at Philadelphia Magazine, move back to Philadelphia and work at Philadelphia Magazine, or stay in Washington and work at Washington City Paper, because I'd been working on clips.
So the story breaks in January of 2008. I'm sorry, 98.
So I'm on the tarmac on my way back from vacation with my dad, and I pick up the Caymanian Compass, and I see this story, and I can't believe it, because this girl is, you know, I went out with her just a few weeks before, and I came back, and I called Carr, and then we worked for a few days on this cover story about, it's really kind of a rumination on politics and power and how everybody was just frothing to destroy Monica, to destroy Bill Clinton. Just, it was just, Washington was mad. And, you know, I think it pretty much holds up. Knowing then what I know now, I wouldn't call her chubby or zaftig, which I did in the story. But beyond those two words, I think it holds up about.
You know, I ran into her in New York during the 2016 campaign. Mm-hmm. I was at a restaurant.
She's lovely, lovely person.
Yes. And I found myself thinking about the fact she was now 42, 43 years old. And her entire adult life, you know,
it's not fair.
Has been defined by this.
He's been allowed
experience.
To move on.
Yeah,
the men are always allowed.
She's
to move
doing
on.
Great work on the issue of cyberbullying.
Yeah,
for which she deserves great credit.
But, but
man,
she should
will always be. You
she
know,
should be off somewhere with kids and a husband, and you know, doing whatever she wants to do, and able to walk down the street without people looking, and she won't. And it's a tragedy, and it's really unforgivable that Bill Clinton did that to her, that President Clinton did that to her.
Was your piece a sympathetic piece other than
very much.
The Zaftig reference?
I like Zaftig, by the way. I mean, it wasn't meant unsympathetically, but it was, yes, it was a very sympathetic piece. Mm-hmm. And let me also just say that knowing her at that time and knowing, and I was 29 and single, the idea that a married father, president of the United States, would take advantage of her, and I knew her exactly at that moment, it's just reprehensible.
No.
I mean, it is clubbing a baby seal. It is, she was a very, very openly vulnerable, young 21-year-old girl. There's something wrong with somebody who takes advantage of that.
You went to Salon.com and you covered, as you mentioned, the presidential race in 1999 and 2000. And you were blogging at a time when everybody else was more or less doing more conventional coverage. You were sort of a forerunner of what would become the norm in journalism, in that you were filing.
Constantly.
Yeah.
It's I was very lucky. Talk about being in the right place at the right time. So it wasn't really blogging. I was writing stories. They were just on the internet.
Yeah, I understand.
And they were, so this is 99, 2000, and it's impossible for, I'm looking around at the young faces in this room here, and like it's impossible to explain this, but the Washington Post, the New York Times, ABC News, but nobody updated anything ever.
Yeah.
So I'd be on a bus and something would happen and I would write it and I would file it and I would send it through my cell phone. And Salon would put it up, you know, half an hour later after editing it. And the New York Times wouldn't run it until the next day at like 6 a.m.
That's the world in which I grew up in journalism, where you actually had like
So I scooped everybody, but not because I was so good, but because they were worked for dinosaurs at the time, and thankfully the Times and the Post and everyone has realized you can't just do that. They're big. I remember the Washington Post; they had this big move where during the presidential race they decided they would do like one update at like 4 p.m. That was their big move, and it's just it's crazy. But yeah, that was I talk about being in the right place at the right time because I would scoop everybody on all sorts of things because it was me and the Associated Press wire. And other than that, no one saw anything.
Yeah. Well, the dinosaurs noticed you.
Yeah.
You got hired after that by ABC.
Yeah.
But you also wrote a book about that race called Down and Dirty, The Plot to Steal the Presidency.
Yeah. It was about the recount, just the recount, and the 36 days that I spent in Tallahassee and Miami and Broward County. And it was
kind of a pox on both their houses sort of story, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
because... Do you look back at it now? Would you have done it any differently than... Do you think you did a fair job of laying the thing out?
I think it was fair, and I think it was... I regret a few cheap shots I took at people here and there just because I thought, you know, everybody when they're in their 20s thinks that they're like the next Hunter S. Thompson. And
yes.
Like, so there was a lot of that I wouldn't... have done again, generally speaking, in terms of the conclusions, the Bush campaign was trying to prevent votes from being counted. That's horrible. The Gore campaign was never trying to get all the votes counted. They just wanted the ones in the Democratic counties. That seems just as unprincipled as trying to get none of them counted. I mean. The bottom line is you should try to get all the votes counted. And there were experts on the Gore campaign saying statewide recount, that's the only way to do it. And they were being ignored. And if they had listened to them, maybe Al Gore would have been president.
Yeah. They didn't handle it particularly well is the bottom line.
No. I mean, but I mean, looking back on it, the thing is this, like, I could see why people were like, well, the U.S. Supreme Court made such an unfair decision, and who makes a decision saying, and this is the only time we will be invoking this principle. It's true, but the Florida Supreme Court was doing the same thing, but worse, less skillfully so. So
I wonder how much, we've seen such a sort of toxification of our politics. I wonder how much of it began there with that recount and
it
the
was,
suspicion that the on the part of those on the part of Democrats that this was just to borrow your phrase, a dirty deal.
It was dirty back then, but it was like nothing like what we see today.
Right.
And Al Gore's behavior after the Supreme Court made its decision was a template for losing. Well,
yeah, it was. He did. He behaved as a patriot in that. You went to ABC.
Mm-hmm.
How did you make the transition from print to television?
I'd done a lot of, talking head stuff on MSNBC and Fox, and which was very different than both of them were very different than what they are now. And CNN. I had a short-lived show on CNN that was just a bunch of young talking heads. It's called Take Five. It ran in 2001. Its last show was right before 9/11, when suddenly
everything was pretty grave.
And nobody wanted to hear from five young pundits sitting around a table.
That's a pretty marketable idea these days.
Jay Carney was one of those young pundits.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, John Dickerson. I mean, there were a few of us. Anyway, so I had clips, and then I'd done a few TV things to get a reel together. I did some stuff for Sundance. I worked for VH1 for 6 months. I learned how to do TV. Journalism, and then I had a reel, and I took it to ABC, and they knew my journalism from Salon, and then they saw that I could do TV too.
And how was the adaptation once you got over there?
It's a big change. I mean, you have to learn how to do a whole bunch of performance. You know, they call it broadcasting, but it's really about performance in terms of how you perform in front of a camera, how you modulate your voice when you track, doing the voiceover parts of it. There was a lot of there was a lot of adjustment. And then psychologically, there's a lot of adjustment, too, because there's such a limited time on broadcast television as opposed to Salon or now here at CNN. There's Good Morning America, World News Tonight with Peter Jennings.
So you're just fighting to get...
fighting to get on, and ABC at the time, and I don't know what it's like now, I haven't been there in a while, but ABC at the time was created for people to compete against each other, and I found it kind of unhealthy and uncollegial by on purpose. Mm-hmm. They pit people against each other.
Creative tension.
Yeah, I think Rune Arledge did that when he kind of took over, and he put mm-hmm. Diane Sawyer against Barbara Walters and Ted Koppel against Peter Jennings, and but it seeped down, and it was really unhealthy and toxic.
You were the White House correspondent during the when I was there.
Yeah, for the first 4 years of Obama.
So, and you asked provocative questions.
I was tough on you.
You and my buddy Robert Gibbs would spar
yeah.
from time to time.
That's the job.
Yeah, but let me ask you. I it is the job.
Yeah.
Do you have any concern that these White House briefings become sort of a venue for theatrics?
My concerns more. I mean, yes, sure, that happens, and I could see. I learned lessons in that first 6 month to a year period with Gibbs that I carried with me for the rest of Gibbs and then on to Carney, which had to do more with the hotter the question, the cooler the delivery. And you'll see, I asked some of the toughest questions to Carney, but they didn't get the kind of attention that some of the initial ones with Gibbs did because I was much calmer. Yes, yeah, sometimes, but really, truly, what I feel the White House, when the White House correspondents are working best is when they're all kind of in it together and they're like, well, you just told Julie so-and-so. Mm-hmm. But,
yes, right.
And when that
because it's so easy to say, to not answer the question, go to the next questioner and try and cut that line of questioning off.
It's so frustrating. And now as a spectator of it, you can see there's so many smart people in that room, and they're so wise, and many of them are really tough, and they work so much better when they work together, and when they try to like, well, you didn't answer Fred's question, and that's how you speak truth to power. Sometimes you really need to work together. But sometimes I wish that I had Gibbs and I really, you know, had a contentious relationship on camera and off, but. I also think that that's kind of healthy in what it's supposed to
well,
be.
Well, I mean, I can't speak for him, but I mean, that is, everybody's doing their job.
Right.
And by the definition, that's going to lead to those, you can still respect people and have those kinds of confrontations. It's, although, you know, your reputation is a guy who sort of leans in.
Yeah.
You don't shy away from those. You enjoy it.
I think that sometimes those questions need to be asked. And, you know, I thought the media took it easy on you guys.
I know, you've said that. It didn't feel that way all the time, I must say. We're going to take another break, and we'll be right back with Jake Tapper. I spent many uncomfortable minutes in the chair when you were filling in for George on the Sunday show at ABC. You didn't get that job, and
yeah.
you moved over to CNN. That was also a change in that cable television news is different for the reason that you said before, which is now you're a pervasive presence on
yeah.
television, and cable needs to fill the time. So tell me about that change.
Well, so. I don't want to shy away from answering also about the not getting the This Week job. You know, my basic take on that is Bob Iger wanted to after George got Good Morning America.
Yes.
Charlie Gibson went to World News Tonight. George Stephanopoulos went to Good Morning America. And so there was an opening at Sunday. And I was George's sub. I wanted the show, but Bob Iger wanted to and
brought Christiane Amanpour. I mean,
Christiane Amanpour, who is
yeah.
a legendary journalist.
Right.
It's, you know, it's hard to argue with that.
Right.
And then after it was decided that you know that her expertise in international affairs, which served This Week incredibly well during that period of the Arab Spring,
yes,
and she was providing scoops at the Gaddafi Palace and with
yeah,
Mubarak.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, but after that died down and maybe. Going to Iowa wasn't as natural for her. They brought George back, and that was disappointing to me. But again, this is losing jobs to Christiane Amanpour and George Stephanopoulos.
Right, of course.
So,
but it does. It also signals that maybe the growth opportunities.
Well, that was my conclusion, and mm-hmm. that's the only reason I left ABC is because I loved ABC and I loved the people there. But I wanted to be an anchor, and I wanted to be an anchor full time, and I thought that I could do it, and I could do it well. And they couldn't provide any sort of path. So CNN had the best offer, which was the 4 o'clock show, and then after a year or so of doing that, they asked if I would do the Sunday show, and it's great. I mean, it's hard to, literally every week, my wife or I say to the other one, I'm so glad we came to CNN.
Yeah.
Just because it's...
Well, and your profile is very high. I mean, you've had some of the most... some of the most interesting, provocative interviews in a very interesting and provocative time.
Yeah. Well, there's no shortage of people to interview about uncomfortable subjects.
So, and obviously I'm at CNN as well, and I've enjoyed that experience. I do wonder about the sort of demands of cable.
Yeah.
In that you do have to fill every minute of every day, and it's such a competitive...
It is.
Environment.
And it's weird because, if I can just interrupt for 1 second, it's weird because we're outflanked by people who are nakedly appealing to ideological, if not party, partisans.
Right.
MS, not everybody, but most hosts.
Well, their business model is clearly...
They want progressives.
Right.
And the opposite for Fox. And we are trying to be this middle of the road.
Although,
thing.
Isn't it tough? I mean, in the era of Trump... it seems to me if just by reporting facts, if he finds the facts inconvenient,
right,
then he casts it as a partisan attack.
Yeah, and that's weird because whenever anybody says that to me, I say, you can't find any evidence about what I think about his tax plan or repealing Obamacare or DACA or immigration, or trade or any of these issues, terrorism or ISIS or Syria, I'm agnostic on that. I want to have full and interesting and provocative debates and call balls and strikes, but I'm not putting out there an immigration proposal.
But it's fair to say that you've hit him hard on
decency and truth. Those are the two areas where I draw a line, decency and truth. And, and I have on those two subjects, and I think he has an issue with them. Those two mm-hmm. subjects.
And does it, and how do you make that judgment? Because I know that you prize I don't want to call it, I guess it's a brand as a journalist, as being tough on all sides and so on. And I know you have had some very powerful commentary at the beginning of your show on some of these issues. How do you issues that you would put under the heading of decency and truth, how do you decide, well, this line has been crossed and I am going to call him out on that at the risk perhaps of looking as if I am going after?
Yeah. I mean, it's tough, but there is this is a very challenging environment for everybody in it. It's challenging for Speaker Ryan. It's challenging for Chuck Schumer, it's challenging for Jeff Flake. Everybody's trying to figure out how do we respond to this Trump brand of, I guess you could say disruption. And he disrupts a lot of things, and some of them I don't have an opinion on. Is it really that crazy to say that our trade deals have been written with the Wall Street and the Chamber of Commerce in mind more than American workers? I don't think that's so crazy.
Right.
There are certain things, positions he said, should we, is it really crazy for us to have border security? Not really. That's his position, and it's perfectly legitimate to debate. But we're all trying to figure out where those lines are for ourselves. And that's just where I think I've drawn them. And, amazingly, he continues to make subject for debate whether or not it's acceptable to march with Nazis, or whether or not somebody who has been credibly accused by several women of molesting young teenagers should be a Senate candidate, or this last week, mm-hmm. whether or not somebody who's been credibly accused by two ex-wives of domestic violence should be referred to as if he's about to be nominated for a sainthood or whether he should be condemned. I mean, these are things that 40, 50 years ago, I thought we'd settled. Maybe longer than that, 80 years ago, I thought we'd settled. I mean, this is just not decent.
But where I wanted to go as well is because of the competitive pressures for cable. I mean, Donald Trump kind of gamed that system, didn't he? He understood it when he was a candidate, one of 17 Republicans. And I think, hosted the first Republican debate in 2015, or one of the first Republicans.
The second one, yeah.
You know, and you had to pare the cast of thousands down to, you know, eight or something. He cut through in part by his, you know, for a guy who now is reticent about doing interviews, he was available for everybody. He was available for the, you know, he would have been available for the Home Shopping Network if they had offered him time. And he got the time because, as he would say, he was good TV. He was the guy who was going to light himself on fire. And he was good TV. And he ran for long, long segments, not just on Fox, but on CNN, sure, on MSNBC. Didn't his knowledge of television sort of aid him in his propulsion to where he is now?
Well, there are two issues. One of them is the airing of full rallies from start to finish with no fact-checking or anything like that. And I think Jeff Zucker is alone among the cable news presidents to acknowledge that CNN did too much of that in 2015. Mm-hmm. I didn't do that. I'm lucky enough that my show is on at 4. I didn't have to make that moral decision. But I can understand why people thought that was a problem, and I agree with Jeff. We ran too much of it. In terms of accessibility, I can tell you, under no uncertain terms, we tried to get everyone, and they subscribed to the old model.
Right.
Look, I launched on State of the Union in June 2015. That was my first State of the Union, the Sunday show. I begged Hillary Clinton, and then Jeb Bush, and then Marco Rubio, well, I'll give you the whole hour. I said to Rubio, we'll go to Miami. We'll walk around Miami. And they wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And it was because they subscribed. And a lot of the guys and gals that are thinking about running in 2020, they're still subscribing to this old model.
Yeah.
But Trump did it. And we would have taken phoners from any of these people. And we begged them to come on our shows all the time. Trump said yes.
When you were moderating that first Republican debate in 2015, did you know as you were sitting there that Trump was in some ways dominating the event?
Well, he was number one in the polls, so he was in the center of the stage. But the realization I had was that there was no Republican that was going to be willing to do what it took to stop him. And that was pretty clear from the very first question. Carly Fiorina had waged a public relations campaign to get on that stage, even though she didn't really quite fit the criteria. And I went to her first and said, Governor Jindal had said earlier that day.
Who was not on the stage.
Who was not on the stage. He was in the undercard debate.
Yes.
But Governor Jindal had said earlier that day that he wouldn't be comfortable with President Trump's, with Donald Trump's fingers on the nuclear button. How do you feel? And she wouldn't bite.
She took a powder.
And then I went to Jeb Bush, and he did the same thing. Yeah. And at that moment, I thought, they don't get it. They think that this guy is, you know, like Michelle Bachmann, and he's just going to go down in the polls. And he's sensing something, and all of them are hoping someone else is going to take him out. And what they don't realize is that the only way to take him out is to stand up and be the one to do it yourself. And none of them had the guts to do it. And that's why it gets me so mad when all those consultants blame Donald Trump's rise on CNN or the rest of the cable networks. They wimped out time after time after time. And by the time they finally decided to, like, really take him on, it was always too late and they looked pathetic. I mean, Rubio didn't do it until the last week.
And did it badly.
Same thing with Ted Cruz. Donald Trump was his best friend until all of a sudden Donald Trump was assailing his wife and his father. I mean,
and even John Kasich really did not frontally challenge Trump until very late in the campaign.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
They expected us to do the hard work.
Yeah. You know, there's an old baseball manager in Chicago named Eddie Stanky, managed the White Sox in the 60s, and he used to say, no risk baseball is second division baseball.
Right.
And that's true here as well. Trump was willing to take the risk. Now, I don't know if you saw, Axios was reporting that his strategy for 2020 is going, or for 2018, I should say, is to try and push the button on these hot button things like the pledge,
and the
kneeling. And he still, and the truth of the matter is, when he does those things, he does dominate. You can argue whether it's helpful or not to him. He thinks it is. He's trying to arouse his base. Mm. But he knows how to push those buttons.
He does. I think there is an exhaustion factor that I wonder about how much continuing to press those buttons will be appealing to. I don't doubt that there's 30-35% of the electorate and who supports him, and no matter what. But people are exhausted, and
yeah.
I don't know that that constantly doing that is going to be the ticket in 2020.
Yeah, I think, like I said, they're worried about turnout, and that's their thinking. As just putting my strategist hat on, I'd be concerned about an economy that's pretty strong, some indices that would normally point to a popular president that have held that have not proven to work for him. And the reason goes to style, temperament.
Entirely.
You know,
it's not about the governing choices. I mean, you could maybe argue on the margins it is. But, you know, they didn't succeed in repealing and replacing Obamacare. So there's been no real fallout from that. The indecency and the weird tweets and
yeah.
I mean it's
but it's just you know I mean it, this there is this this very strange symbiosis between now our industry and his political what he views as his political needs, but he understands that he can turn a whole news cycle with a tweet,
mm-hmm.
he can turn a whole news cycle with a comment, and he does it. The intentionality of it, people don't fully assign that to him. But that is, you know, he thinks like a reality show producer. He thinks like a, you know, and so I think we're going to see more of this, and I'm not sure it's going to change. And I think you're going to have to continue to wrestle with it. Everyone's going to have to continue to wrestle with it.
Yeah, and it's something that people are fascinated by. I'm sure everywhere you go,
right? It's like he did what?
Yeah, but also
what's he going to do next?
People want to ask you about Trump. That's all they want to ask you about. They probably barely even ask you about Obama anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, and I know wherever I go, people want to, inevitably somebody asks me how this movie's going to end. And I'm like, I have no idea. Yeah. Don't ask a journalist. If you're looking for reassurance, don't ask a journalist. It's just nonsense. And I don't doubt there will be a million more of these, you know, culture war issues.
Let me ask you this, given the things we've seen relative to the Russia probe and some of the back and forth between the president, the FBI, the Justice Department, and so
they're still
on.
Attacking the FBI. You see this? They were blaming the FBI for Rob Porter's domestic abuse.
Yes. They said the slow review of people for their credentials. What was your level of concern about a constitutional crisis, an overreach, and what is the role? What do you see your role as a journalist in terms of policing that? I mean, we went there. You were quite young during the Watergate era, but there was this sense that Woodward and Bernstein were, you know, providing this sort of service in terms of shining a bright light on what looked like a great constitutional crisis.
Right, but they were also, I mean, they're heroes of mine, and I will never, you know, I don't mean to say anything to undermine their importance in our society and in history, but it really was the FBI that was doing a lot of that work.
Yes.
Right.
Well, and a lot of the leaking, apparently.
Yeah.
I mean, Mark Felt was their source.
So,
but you're right. But you're right about that. They were doing the investigation.
The indictments were going to come no matter what.
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe they needed the cover. Maybe they needed the country to know about what was going on in order to build the political support and the political will. Maybe that was part of it. I am very cognizant of a constitutional crisis. I'm very cognizant of the potential for one. I'm very cognizant of the fact that we have actually really already had our Saturday night massacre, except it's just been several months long and involved several different people. But, you know, President Nixon having Archibald Cox fired, you know, was one night. But we already have a president who has fired an FBI director.
Comey.
Yeah, well, I don't really count Yates in that, but because she was an Obama holdover, but Comey and McCabe took a little while longer, mm-hmm. but still all the threats, constant threats to Mueller and to Rosenstein. We saw Rachel Brand, the number three mm-hmm. at Justice, get out of Dodge, and mm-hmm. that was probably smart for her and her family. So we've been seeing it, and you know, I think it's very.
Why do you say that was smart for her and her family?
Because she was about to, because probably just the odds are, Rod Rosenstein has not had his toughest day at work.
Something's, so she might have been called upon.
If he had been fired, she would have been the number three, yes. unless she claimed a conflict of interest because her husband right. works for a law firm that represents some mm-hmm. of the players here. But she, and this is not a career enhancing gig, working for the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not. People are not. I mean, it's people with impeccable reputations like John Kelly are finding themselves sullied. Sean Spicer had a fantastic reputation, in my view, anyway.
Yeah, he did.
As a hail fellow, well-met spokesman for the RNC and strategist, and you know, it's not the same now. I think that, you know, I mean, you look at Ivanka Trump or Jared Kushner, people who had reputations and are having issues. Now, there are some still. Mattis, McMaster, who are still okay, but you know, I just think ultimately they offered her a lot of money to go work at Walmart.
She was smart to take it. You're also about to become a published novelist.
Yeah.
For the first time, the Hellfire Club, which is going to come out later. This is April.
April 24th.
Without spoiling it,
yeah.
Give me a little bit of a preview of that.
So it takes place in 1954, Washington, D.C. It's a young congressman and his zoologist wife are thrust into this town at the height of the Cold War. And a lot of different people from that era, actual people, Joe McCarthy and John F. Kennedy and President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon and others, Roy Cohn, are characters in the book. And it's kind of a traditional Washington thriller, but I tried to base, you know, but with actual people and with actual events that took place at the time that people might not know about. For instance, a lot of people don't know that on March 1st, 1954, a bunch of Puerto Rican terrorists burst into the House chamber and shot it up and shot five congressmen. They all survived, but I mean, it was just a crazy time. Puerto Rican terrorists
attacked the Blair House too, right?
A couple years before, they tried to kill Truman, mm-hmm. and one of them was killed, and they killed a White House police officer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was fun to write. It was challenging.
What caused you to want to do that?
Just the I love history and reading about that time. I always thought the 50s have been kind of overlooked because they're sandwiched between World War II and the 60s. Mm-hmm. So they don't get that much attention. But it was a crazy, swampy time of conspiracies and the U.S. just bursting with money and with military might. And people like watching it all happen and looking on with disbelief, whether they're looking on at, you know, the United States expanding overseas or at Senator McCarthy and his smear campaign. And it just seemed like it would be fun to write. And it was very, very challenging. Novels are in some ways much tougher. But emotionally, it was much more fun because The Outpost was just heart-wrenching to write and to interview these people. And this was just, you know, at the end of the day, I could do something that I can't do at any other time in my life. I could just make it up.
Crazy, swampy time of conspiracies. Clearly the stuff of novels.
So. Well, you know what they say. I don't know who said it, but history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And exactly. There's a lot that happened in 1954, especially with Senator McCarthy, yeah. that people will read about and it will resonate, I hope.
Jake Tapper, great to be with you. I appreciate your friendship, and I appreciate your collaborating with you when I get the chance to do that.
Yeah, we always love having you. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.